people are quite intimidated by thinking they need to be this ultra athlete or something. And like I said to you, that's not me. I was never athletic. I still don't consider myself athletic. But it doesn't mean that you can't go and ride, you know, 50,000 kilometres. You just need to, you need to start out.
Yeah.
Taking it one day at a time.
Welcome to Jump Podcast. I'm your host, Traveling Jackie, and I'm here to explore travel, adventure, and lifestyle in ways meant to motivate you to move and experience the world outside your comfort zone and to do big, courageous things with your one life. Let this show be a source of advice and inspiration, and remember that in the end, it's you who takes the leap. This episode is supported by Osprey, my go-to luggage brand for everything since 2015, so stay tuned for more from them. And of course, we're supported by Jump Adventures and our own collection of epic adventure itineraries to Patagonia and beyond. Let us send you on your dream adventure. You can find out more and browse trips at jumpadventures.com. All right, I've got an adventure in store for us today. We have with us Hannah Black, who together with her partner cycled, as in bike packing, the whole way, 32,000 miles through 16 countries, starting in Alaska, USA, all the way down the Americas to Ushuaia, Argentina. It took them 4 years to complete, and that is what we're going to dig into today. But first, you should know how I met Hannah, which was just on my recent trip to New Zealand. We did the Alps to Ocean cycle trail, and Hannah was our badass female guide. So Hannah, it's so nice to see you again, and thank you for being here.
Yeah, likewise.
So first of all, before we get into your incredible trip, which I just want to say one thing about Hannah, you guys. This is like, I think we were 6 days into a 7 day trip by the time I found out that you had done this bike packing adventure into Patagonia from Alaska. I was like, wait, what? Like, you're one of those like quiet, just badass females that just like goes and gets after it. And you show up and you're just like this guide who, like, I mean, for us, you did such a good job. You're so thorough. Like, you're such a people person, like in the best way. And yet, like, you have all these stories that you just like silently kept to yourself until we were like, wait a second, Hannah, like, you need to tell us about this. And I was sitting there thinking, I think we might need to have a podcast conversation because it's such an incredible adventure to talk about this, first of all. And Patagonia, where you guys ended, is one of my favorite places in the world. And so that's why I wanted to have you here. But I would love to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to everybody. And so, yeah, just tell us who you are and where you're from and maybe how you got into the adventure scene to begin with.
Wow, cool. Thank you. Just wanted to say it's kind of hard with those big stories, biking from Alaska to Patagonia. I mean, you guys had come halfway around the world to come and ride Alps to Ocean in New Zealand, and it kind of doesn't feel right, I guess, talking about what I've done when I'm there to facilitate what for you guys is an incredible adventure. Sure. As well. So, yeah, it wasn't that I was trying to keep that secret from you, but it usually does come out. And there are so many things to talk about on those trips, but being in the moment, I think, was, you know, is what it's about for me as a guide and looking after you guys. So, anyhow, but how did I get into that and into guiding? So I'm one of four kids, born in New Zealand, but my parents probably unwittingly instilled a sense of adventure in me from a very young age. They moved to Fiji when I was 6 months old. And so I spent the first 5 years of my life there, you know, as this carefree young child, running around, probably half naked on the beaches, exploring and doing all those cool things you get to do when you live in the Pacific Islands, which was amazing.
Wow.
I wasn't a very athletic kid. I was, I didn't even learn to ride a bike until I was 7, 8 years old. And my little brother, who was 4 at the time, started learning, and I was a bit shown up by him. So I had to jump on a bike and learn how to do that. I don't have great balance, which might surprise some people given how much biking I do now.
I'm surprised to hear that.
So, yeah, as a family, we did go on a lot of, you know, camping adventures, pretty tame kind of stuff, I guess. You know, our summer holidays have been spent at the beach and kind of continuing, I guess, that lifestyle I'd gotten used to as a little kid in Fiji. We did move around a little bit, but when I was about 8 years old, we moved down to Wellington in the North Island, in the bottom of the North Island, and I started going to a school there where I met Mark, who is now my partner. We were at school together from 8 years old, which is kind of crazy, but
wow,
some people.
Wow.
So, and we're still together, and that's going to be 36 years this weekend.
Oh, congratulations. Amazing.
But it was him, actually, that kind of got me into the more outdoors scene. You know, we were classmates at first, and then we became friends. And then I, as an older teenager, I went and spent a year in the United States as an exchange student. And it was when I got back from that trip that we really connected and got back together. And he'd always been adventurous. He'd been cycle touring off with some mates when he was only 15. He'd been in climb Mount Cook when he was 17. He'd done lots of kind of hiking and stuff in the outdoors, and he just started, you know, inviting me to go along with him and to get into doing these kind of adventures with him. And you know, love does funny things, kind of changes your perspective on the things that you want to do in life, I guess. But we really enjoyed those things together. And looking back, so I was about 19, I guess, and he suggested maybe we should go and do some cycle touring around New Zealand. You know, when we first got together, and this was in the very early days of mountain bikes coming into New Zealand, we bought some secondhand bikes and we set off on a trip that ended up lasting 5 months. So just traveling around the North Island at age 19, 20 years old. And it was probably that got us hooked. Yeah. You know, we kind of never looked back, really. You know, we ended up combining our love of not just cycling but hiking and getting into the outdoors and going to some quite adventurous places with our bikes. You know, bike packing, back before bike packing was even really a word for what we were doing. Lots of exploring, you know, not really scared to go on a trail that we never knew. We wouldn't know if you could actually ride a bike on it or not. You might be getting yourself, you know, into more of an adventure than you planned. You might be out, you know, and it gets dark and you're stuck somewhere.
But you had each other and you were on an adventure.
We also started doing some, you know, some longer trips, did a few trips overseas. We spent a few weeks cycling through the Philippines. Spent a week cycling around Fiji. It was quite cool. My family decided to have a reunion there to get, you know, back there after it had been quite a few years since I've been there as a little kid. And my parents' idea of fun in Fiji was to spend a week at a resort on the beach. And Mark and I were just like, well, I don't think we can sit on the beach for a week. So we took our bikes and we rode all the way around the main island of Fiji before joining up with the rest of the family and spent a few days you know, snorkeling, diving.
Oh,
and
that sounds so fun.
And hanging out with them. Yeah, so that was kind of the start of it, I guess.
Yeah, so, okay, I love, by the way, how you just turned the Fiji family beach reunion into an adventure. Because I can relate to that part of, like, that doesn't sound great to me, like going to sit on a beach, because we love to be active and go and do things, you know. So I love that you decided to just bring your bikes and ride around the whole island before going to your family reunion. That's brilliant. So how did you get the idea to do Alaska to Patagonia? That's not like a few weeks in the Philippines or, you know, riding around Fiji. That's a massive trip. So how did
it is
even,
a massive trip. Yeah.
Like, how does one come to this idea?
Okay. So we had an idea that we wanted to do a longer trip. This was without the bikes, right? We took a year off work and we flew to the United States and then up to Vancouver, where we bought a van. This was back in 2009, I think. We bought a van in Vancouver 2009, we had mountain bikes with us, which we kept in the back of the van. We had all our climbing gear with us and hiking gear with us. We ended up spending 14 months on that trip, driving all the way down to the southern border of Mexico, Guatemala, and then back.
Yeah.
Back to Vancouver. Wow. With the van, same van. And obviously we had some adventures along the way, but two things happened on that trip. First one was we picked up some discarded magazines outside a library in Moab, and in one of those magazines was an article by a guy called Cass Gilbert, who's a very well-known bikepacker in the bikepacking world, and he'd written an article about cycling, I think it was on the Tibetan Plateau in China, southwest China. Okay. And we read that and just thought, that sounds like a really cool thing to go and do, you know. Maybe that's something we could do one day. So we kind of filed that away in the back of our minds and carried on with our trip down into Mexico. And we did a couple of days bikepacking in the Copper Canyon in Mexico. Mm-hmm. While we were there, we crossed paths with a couple of cyclists, some kind of older looking cyclists, maybe. They looked like they'd been on the road for quite a long time, and we stopped to chat to them, as you do every time you see a cyclist. And they told us they'd come from Alaska and that they were going to Patagonia. And we were just like, holy heck, that's, is that even a thing? Can you do that? Kind of, yeah, that just got our minds spinning, really. And we were just like, wow, that's amazing. And then we filed that one away as well in the back of our minds.
Sure.
We sold that van back once we got back to Vancouver after 14 months and went to the UK and worked there for a while. Mark was born in the UK and had family there, so we spent some time there. But the plan was we were working, we were saving money to buy some bikes so that we could go to China and, you know, start out. All we knew was what Cass had done at the beginning of this trip. Yeah, we did that. Worked for 9 months, bought some, you know, pretty budget bikes. We warmed up by cycling from Sheffield, where we'd been living, down to the south coast of the UK, took a ferry across to France, and had a few weeks in France, kind of, I guess, as a test of how we might get on in a foreign country with a foreign language and dealing with things along the way, and eventually biked into Paris and got on a plane and flew to China.
Wow.
Yeah, so we didn't have any particular plans on that trip. You know, we ambitious, very ambitiously, we thought we were going to cycle through China all the way through Southeast Asia, hop across to, you know, some Indonesia and then some of the other islands and get on a boat and go to Australia and right across Australia and all the way back to New Zealand. But didn't quite work out that
just,
way.
Just a little plan. wow.
We spent 9 months, rode 13,000 kilometres. I'm not sure what that is in miles, 8,000 miles or something. And travelling through, every country we rode through, it was such a unique experience in terms of the culture and the people and the landscapes and language. And it was an incredible trip. We had an amazing time. We eventually ran out of money and we had to go home. We made it to Sumatra, but so we had to call it a day there, and we flew back to New Zealand. But in the back of our minds, we knew then that we wanted to do a longer trip.
Like longer than 9 months.
Yeah, 9 months for most people is probably a massive trip, but in the back of our minds, we had this Alaska to Patagonia thing filed away.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we headed back to New Zealand, and we spent about 4 years back in New Zealand working, but always with the intention of, you know, one day going to do this thing. This was kind of took over our lives, I guess. Just thinking about this as a possibility and what we wanted to do. So
I want to talk about that real quick, though, just to point out the immensity of the idea that you guys had and how you didn't let it go. And it, you let your lives kind of work towards that, because one of the questions I wanted to ask you was how you financially support this. But I am hearing that you're saying, like, you're going and you're working in these places, you're saving the money. And for me, and I think for you, what it comes down to is priorities. And when your priority is, we are working in order to do this thing, you know, that it makes it easier to say no to things that are going to cost money when you know you're saving for this specific adventure. You're essentially, you created a quest for yourselves and built your lives around that. And so that's what you were doing, is you worked and you just saved money. And then did you work on the road too? Or was it like, okay, we got to make as much money as we can and then we're done for a minute?
You've been on that first trip through China, Southeast Asia?
Either, any. Like, do you do any kind of like remote freelance or anything while you're actually traveling?
I don't. My partner Mark does. So he's self-employed. He's a photographer, a graphic designer, and also a writer. So, and he's been able to sell photographs. He writes travel articles for magazines. Mm-hmm. He's written and contributed quite a few chapters now for books like Lonely Planet Travel, based on some of our cycling adventures. Yeah. So he's always quite been able to do that. And, he spends a lot of time writing up a very detailed blog about what we've done. That started with the trip in Southeast Asia and China and continued also into the Americas trip.
Yeah, I was going to say all of those things you just mentioned about what Mark does makes a lot of sense, because I've seen your website. His website, whatever. It's beautiful. The photographs are beautiful. It's so well put together. There's a lot of resources on there. Will you share that website real quick while we're talking about it? And I'll put it in the show notes too.
That's hilux.co.nz. So it's higlux.co.nz.
Perfect. Yeah. And I'll make sure that gets into the,
like I said, he's actually invested a massive amount of time into that blog in terms of recording exactly what we did, how we did it, all of the experiences we had. And it's become a huge resource for other people who have gotten into bikepacking, mm-hmm. particularly through the Americas. You can go there, you can look at, every day of our trip, you can download GPX files of everywhere that we went. And there's resources there for places that we stayed and all sorts of stuff. It's
really thorough.
We get people contacting us all the time, asking questions about what we did and how we did it and places that we went. And that also eventuated in Mark writing an ebook about how to do what we did. So that's also a resource that's available through that website.
Yeah, I saw that on there.
Yeah, like I said, we get asked pretty much every day. There's questions coming to us.
I love that you're able to create that, that you guys together. I mean, you were in like all the photographs, so I feel like it was a partner adventure, but to create that and be able to journal, keep a log about all of that in order to help other people and also to have your memories, it's beautiful.
Every time I look at those photos or read one of those blog posts, it takes me back and I'm still blown away just looking at stuff, things that we did, places we went. It's just, it was an incredible resource.
So tell us more about the trip. Let's get into the trip now. Now that you went home, you worked for 4 years, you saved money, and you set off.
A little bit more to that. We were so motivated to do this trip and so keen to go that we actually decided to basically pack up our lives here in New Zealand. And I was just chatting to you just before we started recording about owning a house, right? And we had owned a house for about 20 years. We had, and bought some property and really enjoyed having a home, but we wanted to kind of cut ourselves free from that. We ended up selling our house, but invested a lot of the money from it into rental property. So that's another way that we've been able to make this work for us financially.
Yeah, love that. Okay.
We had some rental properties. We still had a bit of a mortgage, but we also had a chunk of cash, which we used for, you know, buying tickets, paying for insurance, getting all of the gear that we needed. And just going onto the road. So
just going for it. Yeah. Just full send.
I know that financially a lot of people are not in that situation. We were 44 when we started that trip. Yeah, so we had done the kind of working full-time lifestyle and you know, like I said before, saved that money, spent it wisely.
Yeah.
You know, and then it had this asset that we were able to work with.
So how I have so many questions. what do I start with? What I was about to ask, I really want to know is like what you brought with you on your bikes, because I've seen the photos and I've seen that. This is why I laughed earlier when you said, I don't have very good balance, because I was thinking about the picture of you with your bike just laden down with these saddlebags and everything, just thinking, I hope you have good balance for that. But yeah, what did that look like?
The day that we started up in Dead Horse in Alaska, my bike was so heavy. It felt like riding a baby whale or something. It was so heavy and it felt so ungainly. And it, you know, we were prepared because we were north of the Arctic Circle when we started, you know, and there was no town for 10 days pretty much. So we carried a lot of food with us. We had a lot of gear with us. And when you put yourselves out there in those remote places, you know, you've got to be prepared for everything, you know, for all of the weather conditions, but also to have all of the things that you might need to repair your bike. And
sure, yeah,
all of that's those a lot. Things. So we... We did start out really heavy on that trip, and we refined the gear as we went. There were a lot of changes along the way as we became more and more adventurous, and we started to take more paths, and you know, we really wanted to avoid roads as much as we could, you know, roads in the sense of highways and busy mm-hmm. places. The whole kind of intent of the trip was to be remote, to be exploring. And if you're too heavy, right, that really limits where you can go and what you can do. And you learn that very, very quickly. You know, you only have to ride up one hill and you realize, oh, my God, my bike's so heavy. I've got too much stuff. What can I get rid of? mm-hmm. So, yeah, there was a lot of refinement. If you look through the blog, you would almost think that there was a whole series of different trips because our gear kind of changed so much as we went. Uh-huh. We were very fortunate in that we started out with the support and sponsorship of a company called Revelate Designs in Alaska. They make bike packing gear, all of the bags that you need that go on your bike.
Great. So, good for you. Yeah.
We started out with more of a classic kind of cycle touring setup, I guess, and then refine that back to a more classic bike packing setup and a much lighter system.
I also appreciate that you didn't have it all perfected the day you set out. I mean, and I just want to highlight that, because I think a lot of people get scared that they aren't going to have it perfected the day they set out either, and that stops them. It's like a fear people can't get over. But here's the thing. I always like to remind people, it's not like we get somewhere and forget everything we know and don't have any more resources. Like, we're resourceful, we can figure things out. And if something isn't working, we change it and we give ourselves permission to change. And there you go. Like, you'll figure it out.
I think that's one of the key things I would say to people is don't be scared to just go and try with what gear you have. You don't need to invest thousands of dollars on a fancy bike and all the fancy stuff. You know, you can do this. You can start out on a budget bike. You know, this is, we're talking, we started this trip 25 years after our first cycle tour and trip around New Zealand together. So there's a lot of learning gone into that, but you only learn by doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I say to people, don't be scared. Start with what you've got. If you've got a budget bike and all you've got is a carrier rack on the back and you're going to strap your backpack on there, don't let that stop you. And the same goes for fitness. People are quite intimidated by thinking they need to be, this ultra athlete or something. And, like I said to you, that's not me. I was never athletic. I still don't consider myself athletic. But it doesn't mean that you can't go and ride, 50,000 kilometers. You need to start out.
Yeah.
Taking it one day at a time. I'd suggest go and do an overnight trip, then go and do a week-long trip. And if it's going well, go and, spend a couple of weeks out there. That way you get to, A, you're building up your fitness, B, you're testing out your gear, C, you're getting your backside used to sitting on a saddle all day.
You get conditioned.
That's crucial. Mm-hmm. You need to spend some time kind of easing into it rather than just jumping in the deep end, I'd say.
I just love that you said, just because you're not athletic doesn't mean you can't go ride 50,000 kilometers.
Honestly, you need to think about a journey. You can't think about a journey that long without being intimidated, right? And it was the same for me. You've got to take it as one day at a time. Just think you're going for a bike ride.
Yeah.
For a day.
Right. I love this.
Yeah, you wake up the next day and it's like, oh, I'm going for a bike ride today. Yeah, how far are we going to go? Yeah, and you get to make that decision. You have so much flexibility and so much freedom on a bike to decide where you're going, to decide how far you're going, to decide if you're going to, ride hard or slow, or perhaps you only ride an hour and you get to a place that you really love and you just stop and you set up camp. It's the ultimate freedom in terms of travel. And that's one of the things that, I love about it so much. Nobody else dictates where you're going or what you're doing. You're not reliant on a bus timetable.
True. Or where the next gas station is.
No, exactly. You've got it. Food's pretty important as a cyclist, I got to say. That was You've got to always have food and water. But you don't need to know where you're going to camp that night or where you're going to sleep that night.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing that people ask us all the time. How did you know where you were going to sleep that night? Did you book everything ahead? And
Did you wild camp a lot or did you camp in campgrounds? Or
we mixed it up depending on the country that we were in. We did wild camp a lot through, Alaska, Canada, and the United States. It's easy to camp there. There's a lot of public land and a lot of campgrounds, a lot of remote places you can camp. And also it was that was probably the most expensive part of our trip in terms of accommodation costs if we'd wanted to stay indoors. Which we didn't particularly want to or need to. So, but then when we got down into places like Mexico, Central America, what changed there was that we wanted to encounter people. We wanted to experience the culture. We wanted to see how people lived and what went on in these towns and these villages. And because we've done so much camping, in the past anyway, we didn't feel like we needed to camp. Does that make sense? So what the plan became was we would often just ride from town to town and find a cheap hostel. Or if there wasn't a place to stay, then we would talk to people and say, is there somewhere we can camp? Can we put the tent up? Sometimes that might just be in the plaza right in the middle of a small village. Or... somebody's house, or we might stop and eat in a restaurant and they were just like, oh, you can stay here, just set up here and sleep inside. Or maybe there'd be a school that we might stay the night in, there were all sorts of places that we stayed. But yeah, we did less camping in those places where we wanted to experience the culture more because we wanted to be around the people.
Yeah, because you wanted to be with people. That makes sense. What kind of, do any like people stories stand out to you? Like who did you meet?
Well, we met a lot of people. So we were on the road for, it was 4 years and 3 months in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that time we were traveling every single day, day after day after day. Yeah, we might ride 5 days, have a day off, a rest day. The longest break that we had was a couple of months in southern Peru. But
because you liked it or because you needed to?
Two reasons. Firstly, it was the wet season in Bolivia, which is where we were heading next. And that kind of dictated, you know, when we could ride. But also sure. It just felt nice to actually stop and spend a couple of months in one city. This was Arequipa in southern Peru. You know, to kind of immerse ourselves in the culture for a while. Mark was doing some work there. And, yeah, it was good to have a break.
Arequipa, the white city.
But just getting back to who did you meet? We met so many people. It was amazing, you know, and it was those experiences and those memories, I guess, that have stuck with us. One of the things we learned, though, was that people that we met were always kind, always generous, nice people. They were concerned about us. They were concerned, they often thought that we were lost if we turned up in a small town or a small village. It wasn't unusual for us to arrive in a village where they'd never seen tourists before. You know, once we got into southern Mexico, for example, and heading down and through the Andes as well, that happened quite a lot. People would often be quite surprised to see us.
Yeah.
But because we arrived on a bicycle, we were very non-threatening to people, you know, and
sure,
they would be
sense.
Just as curious of us as we were of them, you know. So it wouldn't take long before people would wander over and start chatting to us and ask what we were up to. And all the kids would always be there first, and sometimes they would.
Sure.
They would want to take us home to meet the family or something like that.
So sweet.
Latin America was pretty incredible in terms of how generous people were. And it's kind of one of the things we've been asked a lot since we got back from that trip was, was it dangerous? And it just kind of blows my mind, really, thinking back to that we didn't have those experiences. We really really, very rarely came across anybody who we found intimidating or who we were scared about.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
One time in mainland Mexico, and we were heading up into the highlands in Mexico, up to the Sierra Madre, and it was quite a remote place, and it was getting dark, and we hadn't found really a good concealed place to camp. Usually when we wild camp, we try and be out of sight of the road. Yeah, partly that's for safety, but sometimes that was just because we would get a bit overwhelmed by people wanting to talk to us all the time. And when you've been riding all day, you can be pretty exhausted, right? And if you're in a foreign country where you don't really know the language very well, having to interact with people sometimes felt too hard. So we would make sure we were out of sight. But on this particular day, we couldn't find anywhere off the road. So we camped literally right beside the road next to a little building. There was no one around, we thought. It was pretty quiet. One or two vehicles went past as we were making dinner, and then out of the dark comes this very dodgy looking guy. He had a black hoodie on and he had a dog with him. And
oh gosh.
We were like, oh, who is this character? What's he up to? And he came over to us and he's like, oh, he says, you can't camp here, it's too dangerous. And we're like, oh, well, Are you the danger? Like, what's going on here? No, honestly, he spoke a couple of words of English. Like most Latino men that we met, that he'd been to the United States, illegally to work, and come back to a little bit of English. And it was one of those times where you just really have to trust your instincts, right? And he said, you need to come with me to my house, to my casita. Okay, this means we've got to pack up everything. It can take quite a while to pack up mm-hmm. camp once you're kind of established, and we're in the middle of cooking dinner, and it was like, okay, we actually think we'd better go with this guy, because you know, if he's telling us it's dangerous, then maybe it's dangerous. So we packed. He said, yeah, there's drunks. It's a Saturday night. You know, there are borrachos. They're going to be driving past. And he said, I don't trust those people. And well, okay, do we trust you?
Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah.
Yeah. We decided to. We packed up everything. We followed him down the road. It was, I don't know, maybe a 15-minute walk for him, and we followed along on our bikes, and we have to climb over a barbed wire fence and then up this road, kind of little track disappearing off into the trees. And we're like, oh my God, maybe he was going to murder us or something.
What are we doing?
Well, yeah, we get to this little building where he lives, and it's got dirt floors. It had two rooms. It was just incredibly basic. You know, he had a little gas cooker in one room, and he made us a cup of tea, and he probably made us some tortillas and beans, and he cleared a space on the dirt floor, and he really, you know, he just genuinely was looking out for us. He just wanted us to be safe.
Mm-hmm. Be safe, yeah.
And it happened to us quite a lot, actually. People would just invite us in, and it wasn't uncommon to be invited into somebody's home that had a dirt floor that, yeah, they had literally nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, they were prepared to share what they had.
I love those stories.
People are just generally good, you know?
Yeah. I love that. We need more stories like that.
Yeah, so many bad stories. But if you avoid those big cities and those bad neighborhoods, which was pretty easy to do because people would take one look at us and say, oh, no, don't go down that street. You know, you shouldn't go that way.
We'll come right back to that. But first, let's thank the brands that support our show. Let's talk about a new bag from Osprey that's getting awards and lots of hype, the Scuffle. What in the world is a scuffle? Well, if you put square and duffel together, you get scuffle, which is exactly what this bag is, a square-shaped duffel. Now, just to be clear, when it's all zipped up, it's rectangular and easy to carry with its stowaway backpack straps. But the coolest feature about this bag is that you not only have the option of opening it via the U-zip panel access to the top, but you can also unzip all the way around the perimeter of the bag, opening it up like a clamshell, which creates a square. If you need help imagining this, go to osprey.com and check out the Scuffle. That's S-Q-U-F-F-E-L to see this magic that I'm talking about. I love the clamshell option because I am a very organized packer. And with everything in its proper packing cube, I can further organize by packing clothes on one side of the clamshell and gear and toiletries on the other. There are zip dividers to keep the contents of each side secure, and these dividers are roll-away if you prefer not to use them. I love a good versatile bag, and that's exactly what the Scuffle is. It comes in both 44 and 70 liter sizes, so you can carry it on or check it if you want. The zippers all slide super smoothly, which is important to me. It has burly webbing grab handles on every side. Its Blue Sign approved nano-tough exterior is remarkably strong and highly water resistant. So, it's absolutely worthy of being thrown into the back of a pickup truck full of hockey gear for an away tournament. And when you get to said tournament and realize the rain leaked through the shell of the back of the truck, you'll be relieved that only your hockey gear is wet, not your clothes that were packed safely and securely inside your new Scuffle. I wish I could say I wasn't speaking from experience on that one, but that is exactly why the Scuffle gets full approval from me and two thumbs up. You can find the Scuffle and all the packing cubes that fit perfectly inside it at osprey.com. And thank you, wherever you are, for listening to the show and supporting these brands that help make it possible.
It's nice that people speak up and come get you and look out for you. But that's such a thing in the travel circuit, I would say. I mean, travelers recognize each other and want to look out for each other. And yeah, I do think that people generally want you to be safe and are curious to know who you are and what you're doing, and but coming from a positive place. Yeah,
a lot of that travel that we did was through quite rural and remote places, you know, through little towns where they hadn't seen tourists or very, very rarely saw, you know, other gringos, you know, unless they were there, maybe missionaries or maybe, you know, mining company was doing some kind of research in the area. But I think in those kind of places, they appreciate the effort that goes into traveling between places. You know, most of these people don't own vehicles. They might own a motorbike or they might have a donkey. You know, and they see us on a bicycle and they know that it's been an effort to get over the pass that we've just come over, or, you know, it would take them all day to walk a place and we've just arrived from literally nowhere. You know, a lot of these people haven't even left the valley that they live in and been to the next town. Yeah, they'd ask where we'd come from and we'd name a town that was 2 days' ride away and they'd never been there. Well, they hadn't.
Wow.
They hadn't traveled themselves. You know, it's not very common to, when you're kind of living that almost subsistence lifestyle, I guess, the whole concept of recreational travel just,
yeah,
it doesn't exist for them.
Mm-hmm. It's like by the obligatory, they have to do it for one reason or other, or they don't at all. Yeah.
They appreciate that you've gotten there under your own steam. You know, that kind of human powered travel is, you know, it's different to just arriving in a vehicle.
Sure. Oh, it's the best. It is the best. I love being on a bike. It's my favorite way to travel because you get to be outside. There's so much that happens outside of the window of the vehicle, you know, just so much. Just the smells and the feels and the sounds and everything is so
totally
alive.
Immersed so in the place that you're in, right? Yeah, like you say, on every level, you feel it. You're not just looking at it.
Yeah, exactly. And you're earning your way through it too, which always makes a place feel more like I've earned it as part of my story when it's a human powered thing, whether it's hiking or biking or kayaking my way through somewhere multi-day. It's like, this place is now mine. I know it, you know, like it's, you don't just take a picture of it. Like you go inside of that and you can like, you know, the ground and the terrain and the passes and the water crossings and all of the things that you have to get out of a vehicle to do. And
there's no sudden transition, right? Those transitions just happen incrementally.
True.
There are times where we might be riding up a 3,000 meter pass, you know, which is, how many feet is that? 2,000 feet or something.
A lot.
And sometimes those will take us more than a day. And you're literally just inching your way up and up and up and up. And you're moving so slowly and you're just absorbing everything around you. And you're really appreciating where you are.
I've been on hills, trudging up hills on my bike, slow enough to look for four-leaf clovers.
Yeah.
Like it's that slow. You're just going so slow. I look for four-leaf clovers as I go.
You see all of those details that other people miss.
Exactly, yeah.
The other people miss, or they just, you know, they're the places that you will never get to if you, you know, travel conventionally in a vehicle or bus or by any other means.
I love that you guys have opted to take paths, you know, get off the roads a bit and find those back roads, and that's like where the magic is, really.
The intention of the trip was to follow the mountain ranges, the dividing ranges from right through both the North and South American continents. So that kind of started with the Rocky Mountains up in Canada and the United States, and then we were through the Sierra Madre range in Mexico, and then, you know, eventually down into the Andes. And it was in those kind of mountain environments that kind of the magic happened for us, I guess, in terms of, you know, the exploring and the experiences that we had and just getting away from, not to say we didn't go to any of those big cities, actually. A lot of the time we would be planning a route between the bigger cities because we did want to experience those cultural things that those cities have to offer as well. And it might not be a city. We might, you know, we might plan to go from, say, Oaxaca, and then we'd say, well, okay, so what's coming up next after Oaxaca? We'd have a couple of days off there. Mark would spend a day writing the blog and I would spend a day going out and to the markets, et cetera, and getting supplies and stocking up for the next leg, but also doing that research to look ahead and see what cool things there might be. You know, what are there some Mayan ruins that we really should go and see, or what are the highlights in this area? And we really just made that up, you know, day by day or a week or two ahead at a time. We didn't have a set route or a set itinerary or anything like that. So we might say, okay, well, we're going to go from Oaxaca and we're going to go to San Cristobal or to see this thing. And then we would just start looking for the most interesting route to get there. You know, it's like, how do we get there without going on the highway? Are there paths and roads and back roads and places that we could go and explore?
Was there a specific like app or map that you guys used to figure out your routes?
Ride with GPS.
Oh, Ride with GPS. Okay. That's a popular bike route.
Yeah, it is.
Bike
we'd also
mapping.
Use Google Maps okay. as well, but we would often, if you were trying to route between places using something like Google Maps or one of those other mapping apps, we would set it to walking rather than, you know, traveling by vehicle.
Because it would give you the more interesting
yeah.
routes. But what about stairs?
Well, yeah.
those routes don't show stairs.
Quite a few times. By stairs and paths. You know, sometimes we might see two villages and there'd be no road on the map. So then we'd switch over to satellite maps and we'd zoom right in. I'm like, there's got to be a path between this place. And more often than not, there was. Yeah, and it might just be a donkey trail.
Google Earth for the win.
A motorbike track.
That.
And those are the kind of things that we were always looking for. And we would get there and we would like, oh, I wonder if this road goes over to the next valley, and we'd stop and talk to people, and they're like, oh yeah, we can, you know, we go over there on our donkeys.
Yeah.
And going back to what we talked about right at the beginning, I was saying we refined our gear as we went, as we got more and more confident with kind of making those route finding decisions, the remoter places. We did cut down our weight because there were quite a few times where we had to carry our bikes, you know. So that was kind of our goal weight would be a bicycle that we could pick up and carry, like a bike with it if we had to, you know, over a pass or even just upstairs into a hotel, you know, if
sure right
or through a town that you get to in Mexico and suddenly it's all up and down stairs.
Did you take a boat from Panama into Colombia?
To get past Darien Gap. What we ended up doing there was actually flew to Cuba and we spent a month cycling the length of Cuba.
That's a great detour. Like from Panama City or from
Panama City to Havana.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We were so glad that we did that. It was, you know, Cuba's one of those kind of almost, when you live in New Zealand, you're so far away from everything, right? You hear about places like Cuba. It's like, oh my God. Never going to get to Cuba. And suddenly we realized, well, yeah, we can fly there from Panama City. It's actually not that far. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And that was an incredible experience. Yeah, not for the biking itself. It's, yeah, not the most amazing place to ride a bike, but the culture there and the people there and the history there, it was quite an amazing place to be.
Wow.
So we did that. And then flew from Havana into Cartagena in northern Colombia.
Okay, wait. You went from Peru to Bolivia. Did you go the salt path through the salt flats crossing into Atacama?
Yeah, we spent 3 days cycling across the Salar de Uyuni.
Oh, wow.
Incredible place.
Wow. Wah! I am imagining that on a bike. My goodness.
Got some amazing photos from there. Yeah, it's the biggest flat place on Earth. And yeah, because it took us about 3 days going across. We rode to what they call one of the islands out there and camped one night on an island, and then we had another night just camping right out in the middle of the salt flats.
Did you see other people camping on the salt flats?
Camping? No. No.
No. Yeah. It's like, it's high elevation. Isn't it cold?
We were pretty lucky with the weather there, actually.
Okay.
All right. I can't remember what the elevation was. It can often be really exposed and really windy. That was the thing we were concerned about. People had said it can be incredibly windy. There's obviously nothing to stop the wind, but we had calm weather. We had beautiful days. Yes, cold at night, but not anything we couldn't deal with. Yeah, we had a lot of cold nights on that trip in general because, yeah, we did spend a lot of time at high elevation once we got down into the Andes.
Sure.
Yeah, we spent so much time above 3,000 or 4,000 meters that it just felt normal for us. And we kind of joked that if we were below 3,000 meters, it was like being at sea level, or 3,000 meters felt like sea level to us.
Like with the oxygen and everything. Oh man.
We rode passes up just over 5,000 meters high. And yeah, we just slowly acclimatized to those elevations, and then ended up spending months and months at those elevations. Literally, we ended up being in Peru alone for a year.
Wow.
And did we cross between Chile or Argentina? I think we crossed the Andes between Chile and Argentina 16 times. We just kept going back and forwards. We love, like I said, we love the high mountains. We love the passes. We like that environment. And we just kept going back and forwards.
Oh, man. That's amazing.
Yeah, if you do look at our map, there's a link on the blog too. You can see the entire route that we took in quite a lot of detail. It's quite hilarious actually looking at it. We never went in a straight line. There are times people would message us and say, I thought you were riding to Ushuaia, but at the moment it looks like you're riding north, which we would be. Well, we'd go on a crazy detour and go over to the Amazon. We went out to the Amazon jungle on a little side trip, which lasted 6 weeks, and ended up spending some time going down rivers on boats. And
wow.
It's so many cool adventures.
You did all of that. That's wild. And it took 4 hours, 4 years, because we know that, well, we don't have to talk about this, but you took a break during COVID because you had to go back, and that's why it took so long, right?
Well, no, the reason it took so long, we thought it would take 18 months, maybe 2 years.
Yeah.
That's what we planned on when we started. And about 6 months into the trip, we were in Mexico. I think it was actually when we were in Oaxaca, and we were taking a day off, and then that became another day off, and then it might have been 3 or 4 days off. Because we were really enjoying the city and the cultural aspect of being in that place. And it suddenly started to feel like just getting back on our bikes the next day and riding was the wrong thing to do. We felt like, are we riding too fast? You know, it was kind of then that we had this realization that it was never really about getting from A to Z, A to B. It was about the moment that we were in at that time, right? Every day became more and more important to us. And we realized that actually, why have we set this time limit? Why? There's nothing we have to be home for. We don't have kids. Yeah. We'd bought rental properties, so they were rented. It was like, what are we even going back for? If we go back, we're just going to have to go back and get a job and go and sit in an office again or something. And
who wants to do that?
Who wants to do that? No, the trip had become our life. What we were doing was our life, and that was what we wanted to keep doing. And that was the main reason it ended up being over 4 years.
Okay, I love that. Permission to, like, take your time. Permission to take your time. I love it.
Yeah, I think too many people are kind of stuck in this way of living, this kind of, yeah, people spend all their time in this society where you feel like you have to work. You know, you've got to go to school, you've got to get a good job, and you've got to get married and you have kids, and then you have to spend your whole life paying for all of that stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. what do you need that stuff for when you could be out there having experiences, you know? And
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's one of the big things we learned on that trip was that you just don't need things. You don't need the stuff.
Yeah.
We've come back to New Zealand and we're just renting a little like 50 square meter apartment. We don't need all the stuff. We don't want the stuff. We don't want the full-time job anymore. I can't, you know, I haven't gone back to the work that I used to do. I used to work as a clothing designer and product developer doing outdoor clothing.
It's too full on, right? Yeah, yeah.
We spent so much time outdoors and being outside and being in nature is, I think, where people are meant to be.
I agree.
Yeah, well, we felt happiest and the most content and, I mean, being out in nature is so good for not just your physical health, but your mental well-being. And yeah, I just think that's where people are meant to be.
I so agree. I so agree. I love that. Thank you for saying that out loud. I love that.
Like I was just saying before, being indoors, having a job, it's not what life's about. Go out and have adventures, and it's a short life.
And look what you can do with it. Look what you can fill your time doing. Massive bike tours across the Americas.
Cycling from Alaska to Patagonia and just take it one day at a time.
Yeah.
Ordinary people can do extraordinary things.
Mic drop. That's it right there. You don't have to be an athlete to ride 50,000 kilometers, people.
No, you don't.
That's it. Do you guys have any other trips on the horizon? Like, what's next for you?
It's just been 2 months in Morocco at the end of last year. Since we've got back, you know, settling down, like I said, has been quite difficult. But now that we're just renting this little place, we're much more flexible just to go and do trips whenever the weather's good and whenever it suits us. I've just got part-time casual work as well, Mark's self-employed. So, yeah, last year we had a wedding. Mark's sister was getting married in London, and so we ended up spending 2 months afterwards cycling the links in Morocco, which was an amazing trip as well.
Oh, cool.
Getting back into that kind of culture shock and cultural immersion and just learning about, yeah, our first time to Africa. That was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Nothing else coming up in the near future, but certainly always keen.
I was trying to schedule this call with you a few weeks ago, and you were like, well, I'm about to go cycle the length of New Zealand. I'm like, wait, what? And you did it in like 13 days or something, like so
17
fast.
Days.
That's so fast.
It's wow. It actually was the 10th anniversary this year. So I did the first event in February 2016, which was ended up kind of being my training ride, I guess, for riding from Alaska to Patagonia.
Oh, wow.
But quite cool to go back and do that 10 years later. I was really, really curious to know, you know, I'm 10 years older, I'm 54, am I going to just be really slow now? But, yeah, that experience that I've had in the interim has kind of changed my perspective, I guess, on what's possible. And
I love that. What do you think would be, if you can narrow this down, this might be a hard question. What do you think is your biggest takeaway, like the thing, the biggest, the most important life lesson that you can take from these cycling adventures that you've created in your life?
One thing would be, yeah, don't underestimate yourself. You know, I've learned so much about what I'm capable of. Yeah, both physically, yeah, the idea of spending all day on a bike used to just really intimidate me. Now I know that you can get out there and just take it kind of one step at a time or one pedal stroke at a time and
mm-hmm.
you can make these things happen, you know?
Yeah, thank you for saying that because I totally agree. I totally agree. I think that people get too caught up in all the questions and all the fears, but you really just have to put one foot in front of the other and go do something and find out what it looks like and what it feels like once you're actually there, once you're actually on the road, and you'll figure it out.
The hardest step is often, you know, is committing to it, making the decision and then committing to it, making it happen. It's once you're actually there doing it, you know, it just happens. It just seems to flow, you know, it'll, but you've got to commit.
Yeah. Okay, Hannah, we have been already talking for an hour, so, which I know we could even keep going because we haven't even like talked about the end of the trip or anything like that. Yeah, there's just so much. And really, like, the details about your experience, I would say, probably don't matter as much as what the experience brings to your life and how it changes it and how it frames your perspective on how you live. And that's really what I want to share here. And I feel like we did that. And so thank you for sharing all of that. Would you say one more time what your website is? I'll make sure that it's in the show notes, but in case people want to read more about your adventures and get inspired, where can they find all of that?
So the website is Hilux, HIGHLUX.co.nz.
Perfect. Thank you. And yeah, we'll have to continue to follow your adventures, and I'm super inspired by you, and I'm so happy that we got to meet in New Zealand, and thank you for being a great guide. Thank you for guiding. Thank you for showing up so that you can, you know, show up for people like me and my group. We had the best time.
It was so much fun. I'm so pleased you came and had your little adventure in New Zealand.
I mean, there are many more coming. My list only gets longer for New Zealand.
The nice thing about guiding, you just get to share the stoke with people, you know, they're in such a good place, a happy space when they're on vacation and riding a bike.
Yeah, because if they haven't already discovered the magic, they're about to, of being on two wheels. It's the most amazing. Okay, Hannah, thank you so much again, and be safe out there.
Cheers, Jackie.